You're listening to A Views and Brews, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. Find out how you can join us for a live show at the Cactus at cactuscafe.org.
Tonight, we have a really special guest host. While I was on maternity leave, it was like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was trying to put my son to sleep, and I was searching through my email, and I had this great email, and it was a pitch to start a podcast about the humanities. And I was like, oh, yes. And so I got back to David as soon as I could, and we had a great conversation, and we decided to do a pilot for the podcast, which is tonight's show. So before long, I would like to introduce our guest host for this evening, professor in the English and Comparative Literature Department here at UT, Dr. David Kornheimer. Welcome.
Great. Thank you so much, Rebecca. I'm thrilled to be here, and for those of you listening on the podcast, we have a completely overflowing room. It's standing room only. Everyone is just clamoring to learn about the humanities. I'm incredibly excited about the guests that we have here today. I like to think of this as the Avengers team of the humanities world. Each of them really has a superpower, which will come out during the discussion. So I'm going to give a brief intro to each of them, and then we'll just jump into the discussion and see where things go. So directly to my left is Helene Myers, who's professor of English and McManus University chair at Southwestern University in Georgetown, where she's also the former director of the Southwestern Feminist Studies Program. Helene has written on the state of the humanities and the role of public intellectuals for the Chronicle of Higher Education and Inside Higher Education, and received national attention for a course she offers called Novel English Majors, which I'm sure we will hear more about a little bit later, which uses literary analysis to help train students for the contemporary job market. Next to Helene is Dennis Ahlberg, who is the former president of Trinity University down in San Antonio and current distinguished professor of economics. Yes, we let an economist into this discussion. He is the editor of the collection The Changing Face of Higher Education, Is There an International Crisis of the Humanities? I'm sure we will get an answer to that question probably in just a few minutes. Next to Dennis is Amelia Pace Bora, who is the academic director of Free Minds Austin, which is a program of the local nonprofit Foundation Communities that teaches college-level humanities classes to low-income and disadvantaged adults who never went to college. And then at the far end, we have Paul Woodruff, who is the former dean of undergraduate studies here at UT, former chair of the UT philosophy department. Among his many other books, Paul is the author of The Garden of Leaders, Revolutionizing Higher Education. So our topic today is a small one. It's just the past, present, and future of the humanities. Usually when people like us get up on a stage like this and talk about the humanities, all we want to talk about is the crisis in the humanities. But I don't want to start there at all. I know we will get there inescapably. But I want to rewind the discussion quite a bit and talk about the past of the humanities, where it comes from. But before we can even do that, we need to start like the lawyers do with definitions. And so ask ourselves, what is the humanity? What are the humanities? What were the humanities? I actually wanted to, Amelia, start with you on this one. Because I think you bring a really interesting perspective because you are part of a program that teaches the humanities to people that maybe don't have much familiarity with it. And so what are the humanities is in your definition in the work that you do?
Yes, I do spend a lot of time, especially over the summer. And thank you for having me, by the way.
Yeah.
It's a real pleasure. We spend a lot of time meeting people who have applied to Free Minds and are interested in what we're doing for a reason other than the humanities. They apply for Free Minds because it's free college, because they want a way back into the classroom, because there's childcare available, because they want to model education for their kids. And so they're not coming to it like always. They're not always coming to it with, I really want to do the humanities. And so I find myself defining often for an uninitiated audience. And what we do is set a bunch of books out on the table when we meet applicants and introduce the idea that this is This is a field that allows us to ask really big questions about the human experience and how we make meaning of our lives, but that we do it through texts, and we consider texts books, but also pieces of art, performances. Texts are everywhere around us, and they are our vehicles for asking these big questions. So the humanities is a practice that we use to ask questions, to dig deeper, to look closely at texts and make meaning of our lives. But then we do, you know, we use words like, these are our disciplines. We study philosophy in U.S. history. We study writing. So we do eventually attach some disciplines to that. But yeah.
Great. Thank you so much. Dennis, I want to turn to you because you as an Australian and someone from San Antonio, you bring an international perspective, and you've written a book on exactly that topic. So how do you see that definition kind of changing as you change geography?
Well, I think when I started working on the book, I was struck by the fact that very few people writing on the humanities actually defines what the humanities are. As an economist who wanted to quantify if there was a crisis, you know, what size was that crisis? So I went back to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and they have a core definition of the humanities, which I think most people recognize, which is English, history, languages, classics, and philosophy. But then they have a broader definition, which adds in religion, ethnic, gender, and cultural studies, area studies, such as American studies, archaeology, jurisprudence, some interdisciplinary programs such as Holocaust and medieval studies, but the National Center for Education Statistics has a different definition. They add visual and performing arts, and they say that history is not a humanity, it's a social science.
I'm with them. I'm with them, actually.
Yeah, and when you look at Cambridge and Oxford, for Cambridge, it's a social science. For Oxford, it's a humanities. So when you're talking about a crisis, if you're not talking about the same set of disciplines.
We're not talking about the crisis yet.
Right. But we will get there, as you said. So, so it was important for me to define what it is that people are talking about so that we could have a meaningful exchange. And people were very reluctant to have that discussion.
Yeah, we never want to exclude anyone, right? We want to be inclusive, but I mean, definitions by definition exclude.
Well, given that we're not talking about a crisis, but if we were, it's important because you can say there's no crisis if you include communication, but then people in the humanities would be horrified to include that. But it helps you define away a problem, because if you just look at the core, then that's when people start jumping out
right.
of the boat.
Colleen, you look like you want to jump in here.
Yeah, I think that it's really important to define the disciplines that are included or excluded from the humanities. But I also think that it's important to sort of think about picking up the practice of the humanities and the function of the humanities. And it's interesting because as I was, you know, thinking about this and preparing just a bit for this, I went to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and I found a lovely quote, which is that the humanities are disciplines of memory and imagination. And I really thought that that was exquisite. And the second part of this is telling us where we have been and helping us envision where we are going. And I think that if we begin to think about memory and that we have to transmit cultural ideas, but not be beholden to them, that, you know, really embrace continuity and change, that gets us to why the humanities are important and the cultural function of the humanities.
Yeah, I think that's great. Paul?
Yes, I take a very broad view of the humanities. I think what makes us distinct as a species of the human animals is that we have a variety of cultures that we pass down through language. And which grow through imagination, of course. And language is a vehicle for culture, whether it's through memory or through writing or through other media. I think it is fundamentally what makes us human. And I understand humanities very broadly in the Renaissance. It included natural science, which I think is quite proper, because natural science, as understood as part of the education that can make us human, is, to my mind, part of the humanities.
All right. I mean, now we get at that through the kind of rubric of the liberal arts, which would often include the natural sciences, and we kind of siphon off the humanities as being a kind of subgroup within the liberal arts.
Mm-hmm. I think we're confined a bit by assuming that everybody agrees with what people in America call the humanities. And when you look globally, for example, in Brazil, they include fashion and design and media production. In Mexico, it's arts education, behavioral sciences. South Africa is very interesting because there they include psychology, public administration, and management. So again, different, again to Paul's point, different cultures have different definitions. And the French, I could not get the French, my French co-author to split humanities and social sciences. He said, we just don't do that in France. We just don't make that distinction.
I know in Germany, it's often, you know, theater studies, which is my own discipline, is theater science, which is ridiculous to me. What I do is not a science, but yeah, it's considered disciplinarily quite similar.
Well, in France, isn't there the idea of the human sciences? So it's what we understand as the humanities and the social sciences. But I think that that's actually, that might be a very valuable model, because we don't compartmentalize knowledge in and we don't perhaps over-specialize and become marginalized because of that over-specialization.
I think this is a nice bridge into the history question. I'm going to turn to Paul to start us off on that one, because that's his superpower as a classicist.
Well, where do the humanities come from? Is that if you take my broad view that the humanities are essentially what makes us the species that we are, that makes us human, then I think the humanities begin in the European tradition, with villagers sitting around a fire in the 8th or 7th century BCE, listening to someone recite Homer. That's the humanistic tradition that we have, begins at least that early, and perhaps earlier. I think, takes off in the great classical period in the 5th century and 4th century BCE, when there is this marvelous debate between Plato and a man named Isocrates over what education ought to be, and whether it should be preparing people primarily to, in a practical way, to be lawyers, or whether it should be developing their capacities in other ways, and whether it should include poetry. There were already debates about what the humanities ought to be in the 5th and 4th centuries BCE, which is striking.
So, Paul, I want to press you on this, because this touches on an issue that I've been thinking about a lot, which is the fine line between the arts and the humanities. So if you study poetry, you know, let's put ourselves in the ancient world, are you studying it to make your own poetry, or are you studying it for the sake of studying it itself? Because I think that actually gets us to a fundamental difference in an arts education versus a humanities education.
Well, when I teach a world literature course, a student recently thanked me for the way I taught it, because in that course, not only did we read literature from Homer to Viet Thanh Nguyen, but they wrote poetry. And I don't draw that line. I'm against it.
That's why we're on opposite sides of the
Yes, I do think
here.
That if you're passing on the tradition of our culture, you're not just steeping people in the past, you're passing it on as a living culture in which your students should take part.
Yes, yeah, I agree. And I think that that distinction, it's not always necessary to me that One of the things that's really appealing about the humanities is the idea that you're a co-creator with whatever you're engaging with, and that text really isn't living unless someone's interacting with it, that the interpreter, the performer, the reader is paying attention to it, and the attention is a relationship that keeps it alive. So you commune with that text, you commune with the author of it, you commune with whoever else has communed with it over time, and so you are a co-creator in it, and that's part of what's so magical about the humanities. And so inviting people to respond artistically, which we do in Free Minds too, you know, you sort of read the Republic and say, now write a letter and you're Socrates, and here's you responding to Thrasymachus after you finish this book, sort of what's your final word? So you're taking on a voice, you're applying your creativity to the text, and not just sort of like, here's the content that I would like to dig into and recycle and repeat for you. I think that's really important.
I absolutely agree, and I would just add to that that as a critic and as a literary critic, I think it's really important to use language carefully and precisely, and that that I think literary criticism would be healthier today if critics thought of themselves as not only co-creators, but as creators and as artists. And that if we, you know, try to write not only subtle content, but also beautiful form, we will be much more compelling in whatever we have to say. Summary sentence, I think we should be thinking about criticism as an art, and therefore not divide those two arbitrarily.
I like that quite a bit. So maybe I'll be convinced by the end of this, at the end of this panel. Sticking with the history topic, Paul, I'll start with you, but anyone else, jump in as well. So within the history of the modern university, wherever we might say that that begins, what is the place of the humanities originally, and then how do we see that changing?
Well, I think the oldest universities were primarily training people for careers in the church or in law, and the fundamental basis was the classics and the Bible, I think, as well as a kind of oral tradition, but it has been enlarged, and especially towards the end of the 1800s, towards the end of the 19th century, when science became something that was seriously practiced in universities and not something outlying as it had been before. And when the various disciplines within the humanities hived off from the classics and people were allowed actually to major in English and they didn't have to study
right.
only Latin and Greek.
Dennis? Yeah, I think Paul raised a very important point, and I think it's often thought that the humanities are to prepare people for life and the other disciplines are to prepare them for the job market. But as Paul pointed out, I mean, universities have always had a vocational bent. And early on, it was the church. Later on, it was the civil service with the growth of English and so on. And I think there are people in the humanities that just say, we absolutely have nothing to do with the labor market. We are not trying to prepare people for the labor market. We're preparing them for the deeper things of life. And I think that is a real disservice to the humanities and to students who would like to study the humanities. But, you know, I mean, some of the throwaway comments that some people in humanities are areas that will never get you a job, and you'll have to explain to your parents what they are. And, you know, those kinds of things I think are very damaging, and I think they're inaccurate.
Yeah, I can't help but take the bridge right now into Helene's superpower. So I'd like you to tell us about novel English majors and where the idea came from and what you do in that class.
Sure. Well, the first thing that I would say is I think that we not only do a disservice to the humanities to describe them as impractical, but we also do a disservice to the labor market, because I think that, you know, when I look around the world today, I think I want people in corporations to have studied ethics. I want them to be able to communicate clearly. I want them to be able to connect the dots. So I think that, I mean, I very much am concerned about the humanities, but I'm also concerned about a larger culture that would be very much served by the humanities and much improved, and many of our lives would be better if the humanities were recognized for all the practical skills and knowledge that it provides. Novel English majors came to be because I was really, I'm at my university, which is a liberal arts university. I have many students who are borderline brilliant, and you know, some students who aren't, but are very good and very deserving of lives that will fulfill them in lots of different ways. But also need to be able to prepare themselves to live in the world, to get a salary, to have health insurance. I'm a mutt from Brooklyn. I did not tell my own parents that I was majoring in literature until my junior year, so that they could not.
What did they think you were doing?
You know, they. I just talked to them about the different courses I was taking and that I was undecided. And then in junior year, when it was too late to go back, I fess up. They were really upset. And they weren't upset because they were bad people. They were upset because they were worried for me. And so my students and their, I empathize with my students and their parents who were worried about how they are going, how they are going to make ends meet. And I am convinced, and so that was one piece. The other piece is I've been for years the graduate school advisor at my university. And increasingly, I have been the voice of doom. So when students say that they want to go to graduate school, I don't say don't do it, because they have to make their own decisions. But I have to give them my responsibility is to give them realistic information about the chances of them actually getting, becoming me and getting a tenure track or tenure job. I refuse to lie to them. And
a thin line between the voice of doom and the voice of reason in that situation.
Exactly. And so quite frankly, I felt like I can't constantly be telling them what not to do. I needed to give them other options. And so I decided that I wanted to bring together representations of literary types in contemporary literature. So we do literary criticism and career coaching, and put that in one course. And so there are vocational guidebooks that we analyze the narratives of those guidebooks, and we analyze the
always an upward trajectory,
and we analyze the language. But in a But then we also, I bring in alums, and I bring in former English majors who are doing lots of things in the world, and they tell their stories. And through that, we get a sense of the professional, that there are professional narratives of plenitude. It's not the scarcity narrative. It's not the Starbucks or, you know, McDonald's narrative, that there are people who, you know, writing skills, you know, grant writer, technical writer, every corporation has a communication specialist, every corporation has a publication. And so through both, you know, so we talk about writing, and we talk about research, and we talk about, you know, the skills of listening, and verbal skills and collaborative skills. And then they realize that lots of employers need those skills. And they begin to, they're pretty empowered, and many of their parents, for the first time, are okay with them being English majors.
Do you invite the parents in?
I don't invite the parents in, and I was stunned by, actually, I'm learning, just as I'm teaching students, I'm learning from my students all the time, and the first time that I taught the course, I taught it in the fall, and after Thanksgiving, one of my students said this was the best holiday I've had because I was talking about this course, and my parents finally calmed down. And I almost wept. Quite frankly, I almost wept in the classroom.
Paul, you look like you want to jump in.
Yeah, I teach a humanities course to mid-level, mid-career executives who tell me it's valuable, and they apply what they've learned in the work. And they're reading history, they're reading literature, they're reading philosophy. I think that we do ourselves a tremendous disservice when we say and believe that our subject is useless. Because I could teach that material to be useless. And I think I have colleagues whom I respect who do think that what they teach is useless, and they teach it that way. And it is useful.
You can't name any names, Paul.
Well, it's useful to people who want to be graduate students, but it's not useful for anyone else. And they're not willing to build the bridge between what they teach and the lives of their students.
And that's
because
they
believe this horrible thing. That's because they believe this horrible thing that the humanities are useless.
So many graduate students, I mean, professors were graduate students and undergraduates, and they've just been in these worlds forever. I mean, I kudos for reaching out into these worlds, to your work. But how do you have a sense of what these middle managers need?
Well, it's been by trial and error,
right,
to some extent, and I pay attention to them, and I have them write papers, and I listen to them.
So use your humanities skills to...
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. It's communication skills, which I think do belong to the humanities.
Yeah.
So my latest book, The Garden of Leaders, is a discussion of the kind of education that I think that is best for people who are going to grow into leadership, and the humanities turn out to be a very important part of that, to be a leader in the human situation. You need to understand the human situation, and that's the humanities.
That's great. Dennis, you look like you want to...
Yeah, I'm, what Paul said is just so incredibly important, and I've tried to do it at the undergraduate level, because when I was dean of business at Colorado, you know, students would petition me to be able to take another finance course, and I said, absolutely not. Take a history course. And they said, well, why? I said, because if you're sitting next to the CEO on a flight to Beijing, they do not want you to talk to them about finance. They expect you to talk about something else. And so for Paul to be doing it at the executive level, I think it's just fantastic.
Yeah.
And when I talk to parents, you know, and we have to realize that 90% or more of our students and parents, they think that higher education is about getting a better job and making more money. We have to talk to them about that. And so the example that I use is Lloyd Blankfein, who was the CEO of Goldman Sachs. And I ask them, what do you think his undergraduate major was? And they say, well, finance, of course. I said, no, it's history. And one of the heads of one of the investment banks in Houston or Dallas has got a PhD in philosophy. So I think there's this, you know, about the uselessness. When you look at where undergrads go for jobs in the humanities, 30% go into business, but only 40% of undergraduates in business go into business. The differences are not that large.
That's amazing. Amelia, I want to get you into this conversation because I think through your work with Free Minds, you're dealing with a population that in many ways is at the opposite end of the spectrum than what Paul was just talking about. Population that hasn't gone to college, that is facing a lot of disadvantages, and I think there might be a knee-jerk sense that if you're offering them education, it should be vocational education,
for sure.
Which absolutely has its place, but instead you're having them read A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yes, yep, and I do think that like we have to make a case, in the academic world and in sort of the nonprofit world, and it's a slightly different case that we're making, but our students have immediate physical needs, right? They need employment, they need housing, and all of these things. And so I think there are arguments to be made about the kinds of skills that will transfer over to jobs, but in the Clemente program, so Free Minds is part of this broader Clemente course in the humanities, which is sort of a coalition of programs like this all throughout the country. And we're interested in measuring impacts like how comfortable and confident are you writing a letter to a representative? How comfortable and confident are you talking to the principal of your child's school? And those things really grow dramatically through participation. So it's a sense of, yes, your writing will improve, your reading and your communication, your ability to articulate your ideas will improve, and this can translate into these other areas of your life. But that also there is this participation aspect, that being included in conversations about culture and history, which I guess we can keep talking about history, but being included in those kinds of conversations can just map onto how you interact in a community and how you self-advocate. That's very powerful, because we do have to convince people who are interested in housing people, who are interested in making sure that the next employment opportunity is available or that people's kids have a place to go after school, that this is also valuable. Yeah. To learn the humanities.
And I think it's really important. I think so often we separate sort of vocational skills from life skills. And in fact, there's profound overlap. And so that we're not only preparing our students to lead better lives and have richer relationships, but we need to remember that there were relationships at work as well. And there were relationships with other employees and with customers and with other institutions and organizations. So I think that this notion that, the humanities is for a richer life and other areas or disciplines are for richer jobs, we have got to challenge that sort of oppositional thinking.
Yeah, I think so too. And I also think that, we can say there's a crisis in the humanities, but at elite universities, those students are getting a humanities education too. So I just really think that if that's the kind of education that is good for students at those universities, and then that's the kind of education that's also good for people,
That's a great point.
Sort of on this broader scale.
So I think it's time. I think it's time to get to the crisis in the humanities. I think we've already solved it just based on this conversation so far. But just to backtrack, in case you haven't run into this term before, if you're in any of our field or any of our lines of work, you have absolutely heard about the crisis in the humanities, which is this idea that enrollments in humanities disciplines in higher education is precipitously declining. We've heard this story before. We've heard Chicken Little talking about the sky is falling. We are told that this time it's real. I know Dennis in particular has some thoughts about that. just to cite one statistic, and now I can't remember where it's from, so take it all with a grain of salt, but I think within the last year or so in this country, there were 12,000 more STEM graduates than graduates in what we might call humanities field. Although, as we said at the beginning, definitions play a huge role in the boundary lines of this crisis, or whether there's even a crisis at all. But there is a sense, a kind of lived sense, that we all kind of at least imbibe being in the academic world, that the humanities are not just declining, but getting to the point of practically being in danger, perhaps. Paul, you look like you want to jump in there, and then I know I want to have Dennis weigh in on this as well.
Well, I learned from my students who are in the business world that there's a companion crisis. There are so many businesses now being run and started up by people who have a technical education, who don't deal well with the human dimensions of an organization. And this is a business crisis. And I think we see symptoms of it all over, actually. We're seeing it right now in the big problems facing Facebook, for example. They're not educated people out there in important positions who can foresee the human problems that arise as we face them. I think Alexander the Great studied with Aristotle. Lincoln read everything he could get his hands on. George Washington actually had more of an education than one might think. You know, Joan of Arc had no education at all. She was absolutely brilliant and a very successful leader, but she was completely at sea in the complicated maneuvering between France, Burgundy, and England, and that led to her death. Had she studied history...
The stakes are high here.
The stakes were very high. Had she studied history, she might have come through, in fact, as a more successful leader in the long run.
Do you use that example?
Pardon?
Do you use the example of Joan of Arc?
Yes. It's a fascinating example, actually.
Great. Dennis, I want to let you jump in because I know you're the contrarian. When people talk about the crisis of the humanities, you end that phrase with a question mark.
I guess when I started looking at the crisis, again, I was struck by the fact that there was no definition of what a crisis was, which I thought was odd coming from a bunch of people in the humanities, that, again, there was no definition of what they were talking about, but they sure as hell could talk about it. So Harry Brighouse is a wonderful philosopher at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he defines a crisis as a departure from the norm, and that departure is bad for somebody, and we know who that somebody is. And Glenn Withers, who did the chapter on Australia, an economist but actually heads the humanities in Australia, said, and I quote, "a major and sustained decline in respect and commitment to the humanities." So again, we're still left with, well, okay, if we agree on it, how do we measure it? And I took the measurement of enrollment, but some people look at funding or faculty numbers and so on. But in terms of numbers, I mean, if there are no students to teach, I think that's a crisis. A lot of people in the humanities are deniers. They just don't think there's a crisis, or if there was, it was in the 1970s and 80s. Well, yes, there was, but guess what? I think we're right in the middle of another one. When we look at the core humanities, the total number of people studying the humanities at the moment is the same as it was in 1991.
So what are you saying core humanities?
The core humanities, that was history, English, languages, philosophy, and classics. And when we take the broader definition, it's now at the same level as 2003. The core, again, the share there, and I think the share is important, and there's a debate. Do we look at numbers? The numbers look okay. Yeah, maybe the share's not so good. But as a former administrator, we dole out the money on the share of students you have, because maybe you've got more students, but if someone has three times as many, they're going to get the dough. And so it's the share has in the core humanities has been going down since 1993, and the broad definition since 2005. So, I mean, it has the core humanities, as we know, what we mostly think of the humanities. I mean, they've been in trouble for 30 years, but people haven't really been paying much attention, or they're just quick to deny it because it wasn't as bad as before.
Is that just a function of more people going to college and going to college as a vocational tool?
Well, you've got to ask, well, if people aren't going to the humanities, where are they going? And until 1990, it was clear they were all going into business. But since then, it's been much harder to track. In the last decade, when things have been going down for the humanities again, the sciences are attracting more men and women. But again, their filtering is not just a trade-off between humanities and business. It's a much more complex pattern. But what we know is that people are not studying the humanities. English, in particular, and history are the two with the most dramatic falls, and they've been rather quick over the last decade. At Yale, for example, there's a 60% decline in the number of people studying English. And again, unfortunately, the decline is happening across all kinds of institutions, but more so in the highly selective liberal arts and large universities, where that used to be the core of the humanities, and even in those institutions, the numbers are declining. The only place where it's not declining is in associate's degrees and in the historically black colleges and universities.
Any thought as to the reason why? That's fascinating.
No, I was stunned when I saw the numbers for associate's degrees. I mean, it's been a significant increase from 120,000 10 years ago to now 370,000. And I don't think anyone's talking at all about, you know, other than ourselves in our elite institutions.
Right.
But something different is going on there. And you would expect at the community colleges it would be more vocational, but
yeah.
It's not.
That's so interesting. So when you take this broader definition of the humanities beyond the core humanities, how does the picture change? If you throw in fashion design, if you throw in communications?
It helped until a couple of years ago. The big kicker is communication, because that's where the growth has been. And so the debate in the humanities is we need to embrace these new humanities. But I think in terms of, it's not going to prop up your budget, because your new humanities colleagues are going to want their share of the budget, because if their share is increasing and yours is falling, they're somewhat loath to say, oh, sure, you know, we'll cross-subsidize you. But I think some universities are now looking and saying, what would we be without the humanities? And as the president at Trinity, I mean, I had those conversations with all the heads of humanities departments and some of the social science departments. And I said, you know, have you been looking at the numbers? I cannot imagine us without these departments, but you know, the numbers are not very favorable. What are you doing about it? And that started some very interesting conversations and got people going, oh my God, I just hadn't been paying attention to the numbers.
Right. Helene, as a department chair, have you confronted these issues? Do you see them at Southwestern?
Oh, absolutely. Definitely see them at Southwestern, and we are we're talking about these issues institutionally and on a departmental and a programmatic level. What I would say is the moments when we are successful is when we pay attention and think about doing things differently than we've done them before. I mean, in some ways, you know, novel English majors is an example of that. But across, you know, across the university, interdisciplinary minors, ways in which we can reimagine some of our courses. Paul, in your book, you talk about the tyranny of coverage, and I love that. We've got to rethink the curriculum, and I think faculty are really loath to do that, and I think that we would be in a much stronger position if we think about a crisis as an opportunity, opportunity to update what we're doing, to think about why we do what we do, and to say, you know, what are we committed to? And what do we have to change? So, I mean, I think that, you know, as we're thinking about individual courses, but the curriculum as a whole, we should be thinking really mindfully about continuity and change. And instead, we have some faculty who just want to say, well, we need a specialist in each area. And that's unrealistic, and it's probably not good for our students.
Great. Paul, as a dean, and not just a dean of undergraduate studies, but UT's first dean of undergraduate studies, who kind of created the idea of that as an area of coverage, how did you deal with questions of the humanities? I know you're biased in our favor as one of us, and how do you see that changing and as you talk about in your book?
Well, in building undergraduate studies, we were taking charge of the general education curricula. That was our main job. And there are, as you may know, state standards for the core curricula of colleges and universities around the state. I suspect one reason why so many students getting associate degrees are studying humanities is that they're meeting core requirements, that with those requirements they'll be better set to do well when they get to universities later on. We were trying to figure out ways of making it clear what the core requirements were, trying to make them interesting to students. As we've heard, you can make just about any subject boring, but the humanities are inherently exciting, and we need to concentrate on that. And of course, so we were looking for exciting teachers, and we were developing a way of redeploying faculty from graduate students and senior undergraduates to freshmen. So we developed a program of courses for freshmen that were taught by mostly senior faculty. And that's been successful.
Yeah. So looking forward, Helene, if we're thinking about innovation, if we're thinking of it as an opportunity, what are some of the most exciting areas to move the humanities forward, in your view?
Well, I think one, I think we've been talking a lot about what's, and I've also been talking a lot about what's happening within institutions. One thing that I think we need to do is change the larger national and cultural narrative about the humanities. And one of the exciting things that I think, and I've written a little bit about this, and I certainly practice it, is public scholarship. I think that it's really, you know, I've gotten to the point where I don't want to just talk to the 10 people who are reading the same text that I am and have the same education that I have. If I really believe that the humanities have something to offer, then I should be writing and speaking to a larger public. And I think that a lot of academics are beginning to think about how they can translate their academic work and share what they know and learn from people who are not in academic silos. So I think, you know, one really exciting opportunity is in some ways represented by something like, you know, Views and Brews, that, you know, we leave our institutions and we, you know, talk about these issues and what we're thinking about, and hopefully we will leave time for questions.
Yes.
And so that we can hear what you're thinking about and what you know that we don't know.
Dennis, from your global perspective, what's the most exciting thing that you've seen happening in the humanities somewhere to give us some hope for this crisis that may or may not be a crisis?
I think it's some of my younger colleagues at Trinity who just don't think that the business world is the evil empire, and the faculty in religion classics. And I mean, they're very comfortable talking about the fact that their students need to get a job. And I think, you know, I spent 30 years in large research institutions like UT, and making the transition to a liberal arts college, Trinity, because I just wanted to see what life was like, you know, on kind of on the other side of the tracks, if you will. And you know, one of the things that has struck me is that Trinity has an engineering program, but our engineers get less engineering than, say, they do at Stanford, but all our engineers are hired before they finish. Why? Because they know how to make a presentation and they know how to write. So it was that bringing together of the humanities and the so-called, you know, professional degrees that I really found very interesting. And it's not just a generational thing, because there are plenty of, you know, of young old fogies as well. And you know, and Paul, you know, Paul is showing that, you know, if you're engaged, you know, you kind of evolve. And to be teaching executives, I think, is absolutely what they need. They don't need more of what they get every day at work. They need to be challenged, and they need to be thinking of new situations. And that's what I try to bring to my students in economics. I don't want them to regurgitate what's in the book. I present them with real problems, most of them caused by the current president, and get them to think their way through.
Our first mention, just for the note.
I had to get it in there. So.
Yeah, and I think that I agree with sort of the need for creativity and innovation, and I also think there can be some rebranding, like our art history professor likes to talk about slow looking and sort of the rewards that come with looking at something for an extended period of time. And honestly, looking at a work of art for 10 minutes for the first time can feel like an eternity, and especially for students who are so hyper-connected, and our attention span is really in all different directions. But, you know, like, we have a slow food movement. We need, like, a slow listening movement, a slow looking movement, and I think, like, community-based humanities and opportunities to come together, and you know, here we are in a room physically listening to each other and talking to each other. The humanities can just somehow rebrand itself in that way as a slow-looking exercise, a choice that you can make.
I think that's a great tie into how Paul started us off on the history of the humanities, of people coming together and listening to the Homeric Rhapsodes. The humanities has always had a community component historically. Paul, anything you want to add before we open up to questions?
Well, I think we need to remember that the humanities are what make us human. And without them, we're in trouble. So if there is a crisis, it's a crisis for the species, not just for people in tenured jobs or tenure track jobs in universities. It is a problem that faces our society. If we lose track of what are our most important human values, we are in trouble.
And I would just very quickly add that a complex world and complex problems require complex and visionary thinking, and that's what the humanities offers.
Woo! We'd love to take questions, thoughts, ideas.
I have it, and it's on. I didn't even turn it on. It's fantastic. One second, we have a question in the back.
You have time for a somewhat verbose question?
I do.
Awesome.
As long as it's a question.
Oh, there's going to be a slight bit of influence on it, but it's a question. One of the things that you guys have constantly talked about is that the one of the reasons that you're not having the same level of success in promoting the humanities is that there's the common misconception that it does not lead to a job. That was actually never my problem. I followed the sciences path because I thought I was bad at the humanities. And what I realized later on in life, when I started going through college, luckily I was forced to take some, And in that process, I learned that I actually loved them. I didn't follow them immediately because my will to be good at what I was doing was there. And one of the things that I feel is very important is that we have increased standardization in the up-and-coming education. And standardizing the humanities with tests to prove you're good at it, it doesn't usually result that way. And I was wondering if you, and so this leads to my question of how are you discerning what turns students away from the humanities? How are you obtaining that information? Because you're making choices about how to fix it. I would have.
That's great. Dennis, you look like you want to jump in there.
Well, I think what turns them away, I think, is the media and the worries of their parents, because when you look at the data, there's much higher percentage of students who go to university intending to study the humanities. And up until 1990, that predicted the number of degrees 4 years later. After 1990, it no longer predicts. And so what happens is a lot of students change, and I think the question is, why do they change? They want to study the humanities. Something tells them not to do it, and I think it's incumbent upon us to change that narrative. Because yes, you start off earning somewhat less, but now that we have the data, we can see that the earnings of engineers kind of flatten out, but the earnings of people in the humanities keep going. Why? Because they get promoted, because they have the skills that we've been talking about. So I think I can tell the economic stories. A former dean of a business school, parents are more likely to listen to me than they do to a historian
we need
or a philosopher.
People like you, Dennis.
Yeah, and more people. I don't think my wife would agree, but.
Another question? Yes, we're here.
Yes, I came with the impression that the present, past, and future of the humanities wasn't focused on the academia, about all this, the jobs and skills. I come from a different idea that what the crisis, okay? I think I come from the crisis world, okay? And in from a big picture point of view, the West was founded on ancient Greece, on philosophy, basically, or the classics and all that. But we're just spinning our wheels. I mean, we haven't really done any breakthrough. In my opinion, the way to do a breakthrough would be to study the archaic period. But the question is, we would have to get past Greece, because Homer and Hesiod, well, they're magical thought, not rational, there's a different thought. To me, Pythagoras or the Pre-Socratic would be the stepping stone. But this is where the taboo word comes in, the K word, the Kabbalah, okay, the knowledge. That normally Kabbalah is associated with religion, with the Middle East, and that blocks completely our understanding, and that's why we keep spinning our wheels, that we haven't been able to get past antiquity and get into the archaic period. So the question is anybody interested in that kind of research on jumping to the Middle East, the K word as knowledge, okay?
I think that's a fascinating question. I'm going to go deep into my discipline to answer that, which is something we're not really supposed to do on this panel. But I think someone who might agree with you in a certain kind of way is someone that I've studied a tremendous amount, Friedrich Nietzsche, who's incredibly interested in what the archaic period or what the classical period beyond the world of Plato and the kind of late Hellenic period can teach the modern world or what might be lost. He had this very flat view of history rather than a kind of a narrative of improvement, and thought that something had been lost in these more ancient forms of wisdom. I spent a lot of time with The Birth of Tragedy, where he talks a tremendous amount about what might be learned from that. To tie it into the broader discussion here, I think that there's something about the deeply historical humanities, not just the humanities as we've been talking about it here, which is maybe a little more presentist, even though Paul is a classicist, about going kind of deep into human history, that can be equally valuable for seeing completely new ways of looking at the world. I teach world literature almost every semester these days, or in recent years, and I've actually found what the students respond to more than 20th century litter is Gilgamesh. And starting with something that's just a completely different sense of the world, of how the cosmos operates, of what the purpose of civilization even is, a very different value structure than they're usually used to, and just the idea of being opened to completely different ways of organizing experience. I get more papers on Gilgamesh, which I'm assuming is not just because it's the first thing I have them read, but all semester they keep working through that. And they're often just fascinated by looking at a society that is organized in a way that they've never experienced before. And that opens all kinds of ideas and innovations for them. So I think there's something to that.
Let me add, I think it's important for us to recognize that the humanities are not a Western European invention.
Yeah.
And I find my students respond very well to classical Chinese literature and thought, and to South Asian literature and thought. And we need to keep that in mind as we try to keep the humanities meaningful for our students, that we have a diverse population and that we represent diverse cultures. There are many things we can learn from.
I mean, insofar as we have the classical text, a lot of that was re-imported into Europe through Middle Eastern translations.
Oh, yes. The Arab world is what gave us Aristotle, for example.
We have one... Oh, go ahead. We have one more question here, and then we have time for one more question, and then we'll wrap it up.
Great. Did you want to ask?
What? You should ask. We haven't had any girls on yet.
Oh, I was going to ask a different question than he was, probably. This is kind of different than what you guys were talking about before, but I was actually curious how you thought the humanities and the classics would be affected as jobs are increasingly affected by AI and industrialized with all these machines that are taking over like serialized tasks. I was wondering if you thought there would be an increase in like the more creative or interpersonal side of things, or how you thought this would affect the humanities?
Such a great question.
Yeah, I think the way that jobs are evolving makes it a study of the humanities more and more critical, because the jobs that are growing in this economy are non-routine jobs, and the jobs that are fading away are ones that our clever computer scientists can write a subroutine for. So, just engaging with things that are not set to a pattern, and that's exactly what the humanities, and in fact, that's what good education, no matter what subject it is. For me, there's good education, there's bad education. I don't care whether it's in physics or in history or in economics, but as long as it really stretches the student and faces them with situations that they've not encountered before. And the humanities should be by far the best at that. And so I think AI is a boon for the humanities, and we just need to tell the story.
Yeah, if now is the moment when we invent the robots, we really need to understand the humanities in order to do that properly, I think. And future generations will thank us if we get that right and not thank us if we get it wrong.
Or not be around if we
to
thank anyone or to blame anyone.
We have time for one more question. Did you have another question? I stole the microphone from you, so I'll give it back.
I mean, actually, our question was somewhat similar. And I would just add, I think it is mainly a question of marketing. I'm a marketing guy, so for me, it's a big thing is marketing. And so you have all touched on that. And I think also, I mean, people tend to follow into a lot of things. Everything, I think, as a herd, tend to be late. And I think there's going to be probably a glut of STEM graduates at the time when AI is taking over a lot of those automated fields. And so for that reason, I think really telling the story in marketing is the way to go. And I guess I'm just curious, what creative ways have you thought about really telling that story in marketing to even before they get to undergrad, like in high schools at that phase, to say, yeah, STEM is great, but here's another way to look at that.
I think that's a great point. I mean, telling stories should be the thing that we are the best at. Although I think we haven't been so far as humanists. I'm just going to agree that I think a huge amount of this is marketing. It gets back to Helene's point about public scholarship and stepping out of the academy and stepping out of the ivory tower to talk about the humanities and make people aware of it. That's something that Rebecca and I have been talking about and hoping to just get the humanities out in public view a little bit more. Maybe one way to answer that and also to wrap things up at the same time is for us to share our own stories of how we became interested in the humanities. What was the story that made us want to become humanists or an economist who studies humanists?
A human economist.
Yes.
Well, if I could just, this isn't a marketing strategy, but it's kind of responding to just what might attract students to the humanities classroom. And I do think that there is a fear of being wrong in any classroom and sort of a formal, like, I think we have a stodgy reputation maybe sometimes. And so being able to play with things, sort of like coming at humanities texts with a really playful approach and sort of saying, these texts can handle being messed with. They've been around, like we can poke fun at them and we can inquire about them, we can be wrong about them and make mistakes about them, and we're all gonna do that together, and sort of just inviting folks to that table, you know, because I think students don't always feel invited to that table, especially if they've been in a system where there is a right and a wrong answer that they're being expected to come up with. You know, there's this is a discovery process that we're on together. But I think thinking about my own journey to the humanities, I had teachers who presented the humanities in that way to me. As an English student in high school, as a theater student. And so I just really enjoyed that process of playing. And I was a theater kid that liked to perform and get inside of characters. And then I think that, so when I got into grad school and was trying to figure out, should I specialize in something, I visited a humanities classroom like the Free Minds classroom called the Odyssey Project in Chicago. And those students were, you know, had full-time jobs, had children, and would take multiple trains in the dark, in a Chicago winter, it gets dark at 4 p.m. So they would make their way to class to like talk about Wordsworth, you know. So their commitment to the humanities was greater than mine, and that made me sort of want to double down and dig in deeper. But yeah, I think being able to be in that space where you can play and you're invited to play with these texts.
Yeah, I think if you take that playful approach, humanities sell themselves.
That's great. I think we'll end there. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you so much, Rebecca, for making this possible. And thank you for our panelists.